Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Hello, you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. Plenty to come between now and then. We're going to cross over to the golf in Royal County Down in just a couple of minutes' time. We've Ronan O'Gara previewing the Pro 12 final this weekend between Munster and Glasgow. Michael Corcoran is at the Barbarians match as well. We have Tory MP Damien Collins on the Sepp Blatter saga, I suppose, at this stage. His last stand, perhaps. And we're going to speak to an Italian football fan who was in Heysel all of 30 years ago. To add to that, Conor Mortimer has joined me in studio. How are you, Conor?
I'm not too bad now.
We're going to have John Maughan later on because we wanted to flag up, I suppose, Dublin's defence of the Leinster title. And they're playing Longford this weekend. And the way around this is John, of course, had that famous victory back to 1992 for Clare against Kerry. Masterminded that upset. I'm wondering, can Longford do something similar this weekend?
To be honest, I don't think so.
You
know, as I was saying to you off the air, that I think John Maughan is probably living off 92 to the day. He still talks about it. You know, I talked to him a bit myself. As far as the weekend goes, you know, I think it's long. I've even heard a few of the Longford players, you know, they're just looking for a performance on the day and this kind of stuff. You know, it's difficult for some teams when you're playing a kind of a heavyweight side, we'll say, you know.
In Croke Park as well. Yeah, whatever about playing them at home?
Yeah, I mean, look, deep down, they know, you know, they're going to be believe, and, you know, go and try and win the game. But realistically, you know, the only worry is you don't want them to get a good pacing in that game on Sunday. You know what I mean? If they can avoid that and put a performance in, then they'll obviously have a bit of a crack in the qualifiers. They have beaten a couple of teams over the years. They beat Kerry a couple of years ago in the qualifiers as well. So,
yeah. Well, I'm interested to know I suppose the magic ingredient that went into that Clare victory against Kerry in 92. I mean, you've played under John. He's a stickler for the old fitness, with you.
You know, the training we did with Maughan, I talked to Alan Dillon about it only yesterday. We were talking about the fitness training we did with him was, you know, dog stuff, really.
Really? That just, bad?
Yeah. Yeah.
Lads getting sick?
Yeah, some players.
Did you?
No. No, I think one night I did, but obviously it was the Monday night because we'd won a game on the Sunday.
Okay.
So we all kind of...
You had a few.
We were all the night before, whatever. But we were the fittest teams in Ireland that time. I remember when Kenneth played in 96 and 97 as well. Maughan was over the team and hadn't the best footballers in Ireland at the time, but they were so fit and strong and they ran teams into the ground, effectively.
You know what? In the age where we're talking about tactics and blanket defences and, you know, triangles and moving the ball left, right and centre, there's an awful lot to be said for just having that unbelievable fitness, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's not genius stuff that Donegal do and Tyrone's when they play defensive structures. Mm. You know, it's fitness.
Yeah.
If you can be fit enough, you'll be able to do that tactic. It's not difficult to do, you know. The fitter you are, the better you'll be at getting back and then attacking going forward, you know what I mean? And the issue with some teams that can't, we'll say, do it as well as other teams is they may not be fit enough or fit as, we'll say, a Donegal or a Tyrone or whatever, you know?
Okay, we're going to come back to this. Conor's going to stay with us throughout the programme. If you have any questions for him or for any of the panels coming up, 51552 at GameOn2FM on Twitter. Greg Allen is at Royal County Down. Greg, how are you?
Hiya, Hugh. How are you?
Listen, in fairness to you, we're going to come back to the main events of today, but you did suggest last night that Padraig Harrington could have a big tournament. Lo and behold, he shoots 4 under par, and at the moment, that's good enough for a tie for the lead.
I think I might have to defer to Gary Murphy's expertise.
Well, I'm putting you both Gary's in the suggestion. Same bubble in this one.
You're pretty kind. Gary Murphy also tipped Danny Willett to have a big tournament, and he started with a 69 today. But you know what, Hugh? It's not often that, you know, in the Irish Open, that a three-time major winner and former Irish Open champion shoots a course record 67, and he's not the story of the day.
Yeah.
And that's the bottom line here. The bottom line of the whole day, undermining the whole day's play, has been the performance of the tournament host Rory McIlroy. Really, you know, it's all in the sporting context, but really sad to see him toil so seriously this morning in a round of 9 over par 80. Not a single birdie on his card. Got no mojo going from the very beginning. Well, from the second hole, he actually played this first hole very nicely, the par 3 10th. But just went through the back of the green on the 11th, his second hole, at about 8:15 this morning. played a very ordinary chip that anybody, you know, of a modest handicap would not be all that happy with, and then hit a very poor putt. And from there on, it's like the confidence or whatever he has just drained away from him. And I know Gary Murphy, we both expected Rory to be possibly not challenged this week because it's a really hard week for him to host the tournament, but we never expected that.
Okay. Well, Gary, can I put something to you, Gary? The significance of McIlroy's name on this tournament, I was thinking about this today as I was watching him implode. The pressure that comes with being the main host, I've mentioned it before, the attraction, the centre of attention, the off-course duties that he's had to fulfil all week long, and of course the charity hospice that he has committed to giving his prize money to. That all of that has just got to him, and the result is what we saw today, combined with, obviously, the conditions that were in it.
I don't think so, Hugh. I mean, he's used to
thanks very much, Gar. I spent a long time thinking about that one.
No, I think he's used to crazy media stuff, you know, every week. I mean, it's a circus around him. He's the best player on the planet. But I just think he lost it today, got away from him. You know, you can't say anything about his caddy or his coach or his swing. It's just Lynx golf. Royal County Down, really tough golf course. Conditions were tough. I don't think they were crazy tough, apart from when he played seven. But the course was a lot tougher than the conditions, and it just got away from him, and he pushed and tried to get it back. And, you know, it was just one of those rounds that happens every now and again in golf. I mean, golf can be the greatest leveler. You know, your tournament host, it's all about you, and you just turn up and shoot 80. And he probably tried as hard to shoot 80 as he did to shoot 61 in Wells Fargo a couple of weeks ago. And that's golf. And I'm not trying to protect him because, you know, I guess he's going to be embarrassed by today.
That's the crux of my point. I mean, he's not playing for himself today. He has committed to giving his prize money, whatever it is, to the charity of his choice. So there is more pressure on him because he's, you know, I suppose there are people that are relying on him. And I'm just wondering if that played in any way in his mind going out there today.
No, I don't think so. I just think he nestled into the settled into the round pretty poorly. The first four holes were down breeze. There were chances to, you know, try getting red figures because it's tough coming in. And he got behind the eight ball and he pushed it a bit. And he lost his speed on the greens. And when you do that in windy conditions, I mean, he actually didn't have a single putt today. The only single putt that you could technically say was a two putt from the fringe. So he had no single putts. He had a million putts. And it was a day to forget. And I mean, problem is it's you know, we need him around for the weekend, and it's going to take a monumental effort tomorrow, because even if the weather improves, he's going to have to go much lower than, you know, he needs a bad day, but he has to shoot a low round a bad day. And it's, I mean, Harrington was brilliant today, but it's not easy shoot 4 under, 5 under a par round here, and it's it looks like another missed cut. The only good thing is that, you know, my record in the Irish Open is still better than Rory's, so I've got one.
And come here, there's a lot of people texting me today who followed you in with Harrington and Willett and Luke Donald. So, I mean, I tell you what, if either of those come up trumps, Gary, you won't have to buy a pint around these parts for a long, long time. Greg, you spoke to Rory McIlroy afterwards. Did you hear from him?
Yeah, Rory afterwards was an absolute trooper, I have to say. He's a real class act. I know a lot of people might look at the odd time when he throws a club or whatever, but, you know, he's a real class act. He's grown into this position of being world number one in a very big way. Insofar as when he shoots 61, he speaks brilliantly, and when he shoots 80, he also speaks, you know, to the point of, you know, what the question is about. This was his explanation, or what his attempt at an explanation of what happened today, because I'm not even sure he knows.
Actually, I felt like I put myself in good positions off the tee. Then my iron play, I was sort of caught in between trying to play two ways. You know, I hit it really well on the range, and, you know, was keeping the ball down, and I was hitting like lovely little half shots the whole time. And I got out onto the golf course, and, you know, the wind wasn't up that much at the start, and I felt like I didn't need to hit those shots so much. So I was sort of caught in between, you know, what shot to play out there a little bit, and then, you know, my poor iron play led to missed greens, which led to giving myself a lot of 8 to 12 footers for pars and missing all of them. So it just, you know, it was pretty good off the tee, and then it just got worse as I got closer to the green. Yeah, it's disappointing, but, you know, just need to pick myself back up and get out there tomorrow and try and shoot a good one. I'm not sure what I'm going to need to make it into the weekend, but obviously would would love to be here for that. So just got to get out there and play a bit better.
I have a figure that he needs to shoot tomorrow, which is just based on a rough calculation on how scoring has gone today and the conditions that are forecast tomorrow. 66 will probably do it for him. 67 might do it for him. But that's going to be a huge ask. But one thing I could say is that Max Kiefer, who has never won on the European Tour, so doesn't have quite Rory McIlroy's skill level, is 5 under par. And if he pars the last two holes, that's a round of 66. And that shows what could be done around here. Currently, Kiefer on 5 under leads by one stroke from Harrington. So Rory's going to need something like a 66 tomorrow. What do you think, Gary?
Yeah, I think he does. And it's an amazing stat, actually. Gary Hurley, Gavin Moynihan and Jack Hume are less over par combined than what McIlroy
is. Wow.
Which is great. Great performance for the young amateurs. Super to see them coming in. Rory needs a, you know, round tomorrow. And like, to shoot 66, maybe 65 around here, it's like shooting 60, 59 on a PGA Tour event, because it is exceptionally difficult. And hopefully he can get it done. But, you know, as ever, Harrington is flying the flag. And as we saw at the Honda, once he gets a sniff, he's more than capable of winning again, and to get a fast start is really important for Harrington. I think, you know, at 120-1 at the start of the week, it was a crazy price.
Yeah, we've had a text in from Paddy who says, the guy had a bad round, full stop. Maybe I am overanalyzing McIlroy's performance today. Harrington a sleeper, Donald, Willett and Els, all evens are better. Great picking by the lads yesterday. I even think Thornton was mentioned, who is one under par. Fair play, says another. Lots of credit coming in for the two of you. And yeah, I suppose let's go back to Harrington for a second, Greg, because, you know, he just seemed, it wasn't a flawless round by any stretch, but he certainly seemed to play really, really well out there.
He played well in one particular stretch. He was actually one over par after 10, and that, like, wasn't bad golf at all by today's standards. It's certainly in the top one third of the field. And then he just got on a run. 5 birdies in 6 holes. 3-4-3-3-3-3-3. You know, that's 5 threes in 6 holes on this golf course. It's just a stunning run of golf. And it shows the newfound confidence, I think, that Harrington, the restored confidence that Harrington has. I don't think he would have gone on a run like that pre-Honda Classic victory in late February, early March. I think now that he's got that under his belt, he closed out the round after that run as well with 2 pars. Sometimes we've seen him go on a run like that and then not close it out. He was interesting afterwards. He said that he felt like he was stalling when he was one over after 10.
I think through my first 9, I think I was maybe a little bit too defensive. Sort of got myself in the back 9 that, you know, I've got to take a few more shots on. But ultimately, I hold a few putts as well. You know, I hit a few nice shots in, yes, to reasonable distances. But you got to hold those, 15-footers, 10-footers, 8-footers, and that makes a round.
And he did hold the putts today. He was good. And once Harrington matches his putting with the long game, which is generally fairly steady, and then you add the confidence that he seems to have got since that Honda Classic victory, and we're getting version 2.0 of Paddy Harrington, a somewhat scarred version of the original, which won 3 majors, but still a very effective one, who's growing in confidence by the week, by the looks of things.
Okay, listen, lads, we'll have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're bang out of time, but we might check in with you before the end of the round just to see how the closing players are finishing. But thanks a million, Greg and Gary, for the time being. And that's serious golf tipping up there. Harrington at 150-1. I know he hasn't won yet, but long way to go, but still. Willett as well, it was a decent price, 25-1. Ernie Els, serious stuff.
Big money to him, Ed.
Harrington's now 7-1, by the way. You couldn't back him at that price. Ronan O'Gara is on the line. Hey, Ronan.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. Listen, a massive game for Racing tomorrow against Stade, and a local derby as well, placing the semi-finals against Toulon up for grabs. Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, big game, because we've lost twice already to them this season. Only 2 games ago, they absolutely hammered us. So, hopefully we can react. We'll wait and see. Training has gone well this week, so you know, I think there is hopefully a big performance in us, but we need to bring it out.
The first time you played this season, obviously there was a few calls that didn't go your way from the referee, and then the second time, as you mentioned, I mean, have you guys spotted an area that you want to take Stade on in, where you think they might be vulnerable tomorrow?
Obviously we respect them hugely, Hugh, but I think for us, the key is ourselves. and that might probably, that's in no means disrespectful, but I think if we can combine 15 capable players and get the attitude, get the execution right, we could be very dangerous. So that's the challenge. I think obviously when you have a settled team and when you have a settled culture and squad, you can afford to look at other areas, but at the minute I think we're putting a lot of our energy into hopefully trying to bring out the best in our team.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I saw some of the stuff that Jackie Lorenzetti said this week just about some of the players, and not going to go into specifics, but it sounded like he was trying to get a rise out of some of the lads and get a big performance this week. Am I reading too much into that?
I think what I've learned being on the ground view too is that a lot of it is, there is lost in translation, and then there's different interpretations of translation. Sometimes if you translate English to French exactly, it's not exactly what is meant at times. So, you know what I mean? You can be very sensational in how these are reported, but I think what's very different, I suppose, in the Irish context to the French context is that none of us would really be used to a club being run by one person. So, you know, I suppose if they're pumping that much money into it, they're entitled to their rent, and that's you have to respect them for what, you know, they bring to the whole operation every month.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, look, we'll move on if we can, because we've a bit to talk about. Before we get into Munster this weekend, can I ask you, how well do you know Dylan Hartley, if at all? Or what do you make of him?
I don't know him at all. Hugh, to be honest, I've played, actually. It's unlike me not to have come across him on the pitch.
Have you not? I didn't realise that.
No, well, of course, I would have played against him, but there was never any problems or anything, you know.
Yeah.
So, I think it's kicking in. What I said was your delayed reaction.
Yeah, there. it was the penny just dropped there. Sorry, I've had a long couple of days, no sleep with the kids at home. So.
Absolutely, it's you know, I think it's obviously he is hot-headed, but he has controlled that very well. But then he has breakdowns, and that happens. You know, I'm not trying to defend the guy or anything like that, but it's. He is easily provoked, and I think essentially when the heat is on him very much, he controls it, but then when he gets into a lax period, he lets it drop again. So he's obviously put serious pressure on himself, but I don't think people understand sometimes the mentality of, you know what I mean, a person in that pressure environment. It's very different to your average person who can make calculated decisions. He's in the middle of a front row. He's has all the pressure, probably the line-out throw, stuff like that. It's a big pressure cooker for him, and I'm not trying to justify you, you know, headbutting someone. There's no excuse for that. But he has issues with it, but I think he's dealt with them very well, but they keep relapsing. So I think the only person who can probably give you the solution to it would be Dylan himself.
I mean, we had Quinny on at a recent Aviva gig, and he came up before because he got another ban, I think, about 2 months ago. And Alan was basically defending him for pretty much the same reasons that you just mentioned there. You know, he played on the edge, and you know, he's not that kind of a person off the pitch. But I'm just wondering, if you're Stuart Lancaster and you're looking at this guy, you know, big games, it was a semi-final in the Aviva, and he threw the headbutt again. He's had a history of it. Do you want someone like that? Are you prepared to sacrifice his playing ability for the chance that he might overreact in a World Cup situation? I'm just wondering.
That's a good question. When you find a player of such quality, though, you're very hard, especially when you're a coach in a tracksuit, to discard him.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think when you have someone that you know can produce for you, you're just trying to work with that. But obviously, if he becomes a liability in terms of a discipline or a penalty machine, then you probably have to discard him. But in terms of his general play, I think it's very good. What happens with Dylan Hartley, it's quiet, 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 then massive error, like when he got the red card from Wayne Barnes in the final, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A season or two ago. It's he likes to pick a high-profile game, all right, for or an event to miss, because he missed the Lions as well from discipline reasons. So, you know, you have to ask questions then on the other side, is that if something like that, if you don't learn your lesson from missing something like that, when will you? So I think he's running out of chances.
Okay, Pro 12 final this weekend. Munster against Glasgow. But look, for me, it looks like it's going to be Paul O'Connell's last game. And it's the last tie, I suppose, Ronan, to that 2006 Heineken Cup winning team. You're gone. A lot of the guys before you have obviously retired for a few different reasons. And I'm looking at Munster squad without Paul O'Connell in it, and it takes an awful lot of getting used to.
Yeah, it does, but you'll be surprised how quickly it'll move on. Then it'll be very odd for two or three games, but the show goes on no matter how good you are, and he's been the greatest. So that happens in sport. You know what I mean? I think, and, you know, Paul is big enough to accept this, but Paul missed periods of 9 months when Munster played through in a season. I think actually was it the 06 or the 08 season, and he didn't play in the pool stage, and I was captain, and he was decent enough for me then. As good for, you know what I mean, the mark of respect of the fella. He gives me half the handle or the full handle on one side to lift the cup, because yeah, I was captain during the pool stages. So it goes on, and you just think that it doesn't, but like for someone like him, he is irreplaceable. What he brings to the whole setup is very, very different to any other player. So for Munster, I think he'd be a huge loss, but the timing is right. There's a new era of player there. I think, you know, Paul probably really enjoyed playing with people. You know, there was probably a core of 10 players there that were probably consistently playing for over a 10-year period, and he's the last of them, probably along with Dunica.
Yeah.
So it's probably, for him too, it's, I think he feels like he's done all he could there, and he has done all he could there, and it's time for him to take on another challenge.
Yeah, and I think it's brilliant that he's going to France. It looks like, I mean, he hasn't confirmed anything, but it looks like he is going. And, you know, to get that year experiencing something else, if he does decide to do it, I mean, you couldn't begrudge him that.
It's not even begrudging you. I think he needs to taste it and appreciate it for himself, because the game is changing a bit too, and he has so much to offer the game. But I think he deserves that.
Yeah.
He deserves exactly what he wants to do, because he has driven one whole province, I wouldn't say single-handedly, but very much to the front of it for close on 15 years.
Yeah, okay. Do you think Munster will win this weekend?
I hope so. I think Glasgow will be disappointed how they played against Ulster, and I think you know, Omani, O'Connell, both, they're probably the people that bring the big game experience. I think Munster have more probably leaders than Glasgow, and on a firm pitch, I think Munster can do damage with Earls in the wider channels. That's my brief synopsis.
Okay, cool. Yeah, listen, and we're just mad stuck for time with everyone on tonight. Thanks, Manny, for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Best of luck tomorrow night as well.
Yeah, good man, Hugh.
Cheers, Ron. Thanks, man.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye. Ronan O'Gara there. Brilliant stuff, as always, from him. Okay, Michael Corcoran is down at Thomond Park ahead of Ireland's game against the Barbarians tonight. Michael, close to kick-off now. And what's it like down there? Is there much of a crowd?
They're beginning to file in. Somewhere north of 16,000 tickets have been sold for the match. Conditions are absolutely perfect. I mean, the pitch is like a billiard table out there in front of me. There's no rain. The sun is, we've late evening sun here, so they're expecting a good sort of walk-up factor as well. And the Shannon Gospel Choir in the middle of the pitch. So there's a kind of a summery feel to the whole thing, if you understand what I mean. And yeah, I know from talking to, I'm name dropping here, talking to Robbie Deans a while ago before the start of this match, they've come to play a match, really, to be fair about it. So I think all the pressure is going to be on Ireland to deliver.
Big chance for a few players, Michael. Ian Madigan obviously hasn't played a lot of fly half. Paddy Jackson waiting in the wings to come on. But also you got to look at like Tadhg Furlong, I suppose, and then the likes of Colley O'Shea at centre, who played the Ulster Bank League final only about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fantastic chance for him. I mean, he was name-checked by Joe Smith yesterday at the team naming. You know, Colley O'Shea up against Joe Rakitoko. Gosh, I mean, it's incredible, to be fair about it. I mean, as a young man growing up, I know he's had a kind of blighted last couple of years in terms of injury, but I mean, he's been shooting the lights out in, you know, with Clontarf this year in the Ulster Bank League and previous years as well. So it's a massive chance for him. I mean, you've mentioned Tadhg Furlong. He's another fellow who's, I think, on a fast road to success. You know, he's been involved in the periphery with Ireland every squad session that there has been, you know, for the Six Nations, for the last November series. Tadhg Furlong has been there. from New Ross. And I'll tell you something, I mean, there's going to be massive pressure on Marty Moore to deliver and get back in, because when Mike Ross retires, I think Tyke Furlan could very well be the starting number three for Ireland. I mean, he's held in massive, massive regard, and in coaching terms, he is a huge unit, to be fair about it. And it's also brilliant to see Luke Marshall back in a green shirt as well. I mean, his last appearance for Ireland was the first test match against Argentina on the tour last year. He's been out, obviously, for a long time with concussion-related injuries. So it's great to see him kind of plucked from nowhere, if you understand what I mean, and back in playing competitive rugby again.
Tyke Furlan describes himself as a fine hunk of Wexford beef. That's exactly what he is.
Well, I tell you, so I was at the New Ross dinner, actually, last year, and he was sitting next to me, and He's a tremendous dinner companion, to be perfect. Yeah.
You know? I think I know what you mean there.
Because I had Tyke Furlan on one side and Sean O'Brien on the other side. So
brilliant.
I think I better not say any more, just in case the lawyers are listening. You know,
just one final one. I mean, look, you're looking at Ireland here. The structured style of Joe Schmidt that we've come to know and love versus the Babas, anything goes. It should be an interesting clash of styles.
That's exactly the point. You know. That's what I'm saying, there's kind of more pressure on Ireland. Yeah, there's a few fellas there who've obviously been involved with Ireland competitively for a long period of time. There are other people who will be trying to sort of catch the coach's eye, if you understand what I mean. You know, given the fact, yes, it's towards the end of a rugby season, but it's also, you know, an expanded squad for the Rugby World Cup being issued, a 50-strong squad, you know, in a couple of weeks' time, in the middle of June. And, you know, you'll have fellas like Robbie Dyack kind of going, listen, geez, don't forget about me, would you? You know, when it comes to squads like that. So it's a big opportunity. It does have an end of feeling, an end of season feel about the whole thing. But I just think that kind of structured Ireland might prevail over unstructured barbarians. But certainly, the Limerick public have voted in terms of numbers coming out here. So I think we're in for a bit of a belter of a match, to be fair.
Super stuff, Michael. Thanks, Milene. Enjoy it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, you.
Michael Corcoran there at Thomond Park. Yeah, should be interesting. The Barbarians plus 9 is interesting as well. Stay with me. Back after these.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
At the Irish Open, Maximilian Kiefer has dropped a shot on 16, so he's gone to 4 under par with 1 to play. He needs to par that to tie with Harrington for the lead on 4 under par. Okay, we're talking Gaelic Games now, and long forget their Leinster Championship campaign underway this weekend. Handy one for them. They're up against the defending champions in Dublin's back garden in Croke Park. John Mon is on the line. Before we get to John, have a listen to a clip from the Munster football final in 1992, when Clare shocked, well, pretty much everyone, to beat Kerry and lift the title.
A point here will ensure victory, perhaps. Killeen on the run, puts it over the bar. As I look at the watch, 34 minutes and 50 seconds gone as Maurice Fitzgerald takes the free. Trying to drop it in. It's going in and it's gone over the bar to Jerry Killeen, just to put the icing on the cake. Oh, yes! It's a sweet, wonderful cake. Kerry have been beaten in the shock of the year, possibly the shock of the decade, and I can tell you that there won't be a cow milked in County Clare for at least a week.
Well, I don't think there was either. Conor Mortimer is obviously still with me in studio. John is on the line. John, that must still bring a smile to your face, even after what, 23 years now?
The young, handsome Marty Morrissey with that famous line. Yeah, it certainly does. It was a memorable occasion, and not quite a miracle, but certainly fairy tale stuff from my point of view. I was lucky and privileged enough to be involved with a great bunch of lads. And I went down there in 1990. It was my first, I was only a young kid at the time. I got injured playing for Mayo, and I was asked to take over the Clare football team, which was a great honour and a privilege for me. And unfortunately, I arrived into a county that was, a group of players that were just, not focused, and they were heading in the wrong direction. And I suppose my job was to point them in a different direction. And as I say, winning that Munster title was certainly a fairy tale and provides me with so many happy memories.
Connor is beside me, and Connor has been telling me that he was never as fit as when he played under you. Was that the formula for your success in Clare? You got them in shape, you got them in unbelievable shape, and then they just went at it.
Well, Hugh, we were talking about a different era. Shocks are of that magnitude won't happen in the modern game. Things have moved on so much. But certainly when I arrived down in 1990, I think the first training session I went to, there was only 11 or 12 guys who had turned up for training. the previous week they had played an All-Ireland B Championship game against Sligo, and I think the bus driver, not quite exaggerating here, but I think the bus driver did pull on a set of togs. Don't know did he get a game, but the previous year's championship, they've been hammered, I think, by 18 points on a score of, I think, of 18 points by Tipperary. They were heading no place. But the reality was there were some wonderful quality players here. Like, I mean, Noel Roach, I knew him from my army days, and Jojo Ryan, just to mention two. And I knew how passionate and what great love they had for Gaelic football. And I do recall on a couple of occasions when I was playing for Mayo myself, playing Clare in challenge games, and I knew how they had some really, really talented quality footballers. And I must admit, I felt it was a great opportunity for me to cut my teeth in management, and I, as I say, I had nothing but happy memories. But going into that Munster final, Hugh, I might mention, we had a wonderful run. I think we got to a National League semi-final, played against a Meath team that had a full forward line of a young, dynamic Bernard Flynn, Stafford and Conor O'Rourke. So, and we only lost that league quarter-final by 2 points. So I knew there was something going to happen. I knew if we got ourselves in shape, we were going to have a great chance of landing a big one. And thankfully, we had a little bit of luck on the way on the occasion down in Limerick, and we were privileged enough to get over the line.
Yeah, but Sean, I wince when you say that the days of big upsets are gone. I just can't allow myself to think that they're gone. I mean, well, is there no chance that Longford can go to Croke Park and beat Dublin this weekend?
Well, the other big shock, of course, was in 1994, Leitrim landing a Connacht title, but we haven't seen anything of that magnitude since, and the modern game doesn't allow it, because now we're talking about mass defences and one thing another. And of course, I'd love to see Longford create a shock on Sunday. Not that I have anything against Dublin, but it would be just wonderful for the game. But unfortunately, we live in the real world. That's not going to happen. Longford have absolutely no chance. I do recall being at a game in Pierce Stadium, or Pierce Park, I should say, in Longford, a couple of years ago, when they ran Dublin to a point or two. They had a great chance on that occasion. But the fact that Dublin have home advantage, Croke Park, this is just a spin in the park for them. Like, I mean, I think this Dublin team won't be tested in Leinster this year. I think they'll sail to an All-Ireland quarter-final, perhaps a semi-final, without a real test. Longford had their day in the sun, beating Offaly 2 weeks ago. A reversal of the National League football Division 4 football final. I think they've had their day out. I don't think they have any chance on Sunday. I've got to be honest with you.
Connor, you'd agree with that?
I think, look at first, Johnny, in a nightclub there, or where are you?
No, I'm actually down here. I'm down here. Thank you very much for that comment.
Wouldn't be the first time.
But I'm down here watching the Barbarians and Ireland. They're just about to get underway in about 5 minutes' time. So I'm here in Limerick and Thomond Park.
You'd have to agree with what John is saying there in relation to the Longford game as well at the weekend. I mean, where I'm based now, Dublin are training in our facility at the moment.
And yeah. It's professional stuff.
They were away there for 2 weeks and two training camps. I think one was in Clare and one somewhere else as well. Just slogging fitness wise, and you know they're doing three collective weight sessions a week as well. And
because you're a fitness coach and you're doing it at the moment, and for you to say that it's impressive what they're doing means that they must be doing serious work.
They're with NADA. You see, NADA are one of the top SNCs in the country as well, and you know all of their players are physically very strong, very fit. You know, every team is doing it, don't get me wrong. Just the difference with Dublin, they probably have 17, 18 good quality footballers as well that can all add something. And you know, Dublin have a good bench this year as well, and you know, I can't really see anything other than Dublin winning by probably 10 points or at least on Sunday.
Okay, well look, John, we'll let you go enjoy the match. Thanks many for talking to us. We'll get you next week if that's okay.
Thanks, Hugh. See you.
Cheers, see you, John. Thanks for having pubs.
Okay, we're going to move on if we can, because the clock is against us. Now, tomorrow is the 30-year anniversary of the Heysel disaster. And while for most people, the events of that day may be just another chapter in the history of sporting tragedies, for those that were there to witnesses, it is so much more. I'm delighted to welcome into studio Damiano Vizzosi. Sorry about that. Who was one such person who was there. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
What are your memories? What are your memories of that day?
There are several of them. And I was 16 at the time. And it was my first time abroad without my parents. And it was the first time I took an airplane. So it was a really big day for me. That was a huge football fan at the time. And
sorry, we're just going to move the microphones here. That's much better. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So yeah, it was a big... Okay. Yeah, so it was a big day for you, obviously, yeah.
And if I have to think about all the day and everything what happened, it was just a violent unexpected, totally unexpected, and of course, undesired experience. So, in just one word, a shocking experience. Then you are going through details if you want, of course.
I've read a lot of reports about the build-up to the match itself, and a lot of them contain descriptions of Liverpool fans who've been drinking throughout the day and, you know, had been in that kind of party, getting raucous atmosphere, building up towards kickoff. Did you see much of that on your way into the ground?
Yes. In the morning when I arrived in Brussels, we went in the city centre and I went in the Grand Place, the heart of the city. It was full of Liverpool fans. Some of them were drinking heavily. And it was the first moment I saw something that I didn't like, even if I wasn't scary at the moment. Because some of them were drinking heavy, throwing bottles in historic places, or they were urinating in the square. They were sleeping or throwing up in the square. And no one was controlling them. I said, it's strange because this is the heart of the town. I think it wouldn't be allowed to do this in Piazza della Signoria in Florence, where I was born and raised near them. There, this was the first thing. So it's true. Some of them were drinking heavily throughout the day. This scene I've just heard was in the morning, late in the morning, midday or 1 p.m.
So did you begin to feel uneasy, or did you just think, ah, they've had a few drinks, there's no real trouble here, we're not in any real danger, or was there something more to it?
There was no contact with Juventus fans at the moment. Okay. So it seemed to be well organized, the game. So I wasn't surprised to hear and to see English fans drinking heavily at the game, because there was the years of hooliganism, you know, of course. And so, there wasn't a big concern at the moment.
Okay, so you go into the stadium, yes, and you take your place at the right end of the stand, and what starts to happen? When did you start to feel there's trouble here?
Okay, first of all, just a little thing on the stadium. It was built in a particular way. The stands, the area behind the posts, weren't built in concrete from the ground. They were placed on two hills. So when you were outside, you just saw a 3 meters wall, with some doors, and you went in. But they were just three doors, just a regular house door for thousands of people. So I needed more than 2 hours to get in.
Wow.
This was the first strange, bad thing, because I saw that the stadium wasn't adequate for the occasion. You saw grass from the wall, like it was deteriorating. And so as soon as I entered, I say, of course, you were at the top of the stadium. They say, don't go too low, because otherwise I don't want to make 2 hours of crowd again to get out.
Yeah.
That was the key decision I made that day.
You.
Yes. I was, 10, 15 meters below the doors. So when that happened, I was pushed to the doors.
And I'm imagining...
Just to answer the question, sorry. Yeah. And as soon as I entered, so we were close to the Liverpool fans, and I saw there was no police in between us. It was exactly five policemen.
Five policemen.
In the only area of the stadium with contacts between the two group of fans. And they start throwing bottles through us. To provoke a riot, but there wasn't the hard Juventus fans there. It was on the other side of
the
stadium.
The ultras.
And since they saw no reaction, they grabbed down the iron net dividing the two parts of the stands, and they charged. It was everything from the beginning of the bottles throwing to the charge was something like 5-10 minutes.
And what are you thinking as you're watching this?
At the throwing of the bottles, I was still hoping for the police to arrive, of course. They are looking at it. But they went in the English fans area. They took out some people, arrested, but let's say 4 or 5, and nothing more. No police entered in the sector. And when they grabbed down the iron net, I started to really have to have fear, because what's going to happen? Where are we going to? I was worried because I knew that there was just so few and so narrow doors.
Mm.
And when they charged, as you can imagine, there was a sort of big human hue that created, because they charged in the center of the crowd.
Mm.
So everyone was pushing on the top, on the bottom, and on the wall at the end of it. And we were immediately pushed to the doors. And the worst moment is when I felt that no one of us was touching the ground with the feet. We were just a huge human wave going.
So you had no control?
No, absolutely. No control.
What age were you at the time?
16.
16 years of age. I mean, there are people I know who get claustrophobic in crowds, you know, and as a result, they don't like to go to see live sporting occasions. I mean, it's not as bad now, but they just don't like to be involved in large crowds. I'm trying to imagine a 16-year-old boy whose feet are lifted off the ground and carried as rioters come in looking to do damage and to hurt people. And I'm wondering what you're thinking at this time.
And I also hope I told myself I give shoulders to the Liverpool fans. I mean, I had hundreds of people between me and the end of this, let's say, this natural hue of human hue. And I looked at the doors and tried to stay, to stand through until I get to the door, because it was a real stand, you know, with the small, small pieces of concrete that you could fall down.
Okay.
And the worst moment at all where I really had fear, it was when I hit someone who had already fallen. Oh. Everyone was jumping at him. And my friend behind me took me by my neck and grabbed him up.
And then, saved him?
Yeah, saved me. I could have... No, he took
saved,
me...
Took
I,
you yeah, up, sorry.
I hit his feet. I was falling down. And he took me up, and we exit the stadium, and that there was the stress. I felt relieved, but I cried for the tension and the adrenaline and so forth. And I remember the first thing that I saw, it was a man who was probably in his 40s, well, like me now, more or less. And he was panicking because he was outside. He was shouting, Marco, 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 because his son was inside. Then I started the long trip to go, because decided to go north, of course, not through the English fence area, but through the center stand, think that it was the most protected. And we saw some English fans leaving the stadium, mostly families. It was they were worried, like us, what could happen. And there was a small, some trees behind that part of the stadium. So you had to all walk around and go down that hill. And you arrived in the main in the square outside the main entrance of the stadium. And then I saw the vets coming out on the wooden gates.
Mm.
And that was the first time. I had no perception of the wall falling. Okay. I didn't know what happened inside. Yeah. And I saw these bodies on these the iron gates.
Okay.
And covered with the flags, black and white flags. And I remember I saw one of them, and it was his shirt was all destroyed, so you could see from the belt and up. It was one big bruise from the belt to the head, because it was so compressed that he suffocated. And remember that my friend touched him, and he told me, "You don't feel the ribs." What do you say? It's like, how can I say in English? Pudding. It was so compressed that he didn't stand the pressure. And the other very, very bad moment was when I saw a kid, probably 12 or 13 years old, looking for and finding his father among the bodies.
Oh, my God.
And then the worst part of the night was over. I knew that the world collapsed when I went to my bus, was supposed to bring me back to the airport, and some of my other people traveling with me told me that happened. And they had to wait for the game, and so the game that was played, and all the we tried in every way to contact our families, because there were no mobiles at the time.
Mm.
And I succeeded around 1:30 in the night, because when we arrived at the airport, because before it was impossible.
I mean, that image, I have an image of my head of a 16-year-old you just being caught by your friend. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, but for that, who knows what would have happened to you?
Yeah, probably. I think, I have no idea, but I think that the people below me was already dead when I fell on him, I think.
Do you think about it much? Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary, and I'm just wondering how an experience like that stays with you. Does it stay with you? Do you try not to think about it?
Yes, it happens, I think. It happens, first of all, in the first few, a couple of years after the experience, it wasn't that easy to find myself in a crowd, even when I went to concerts or...
Yeah.
I remember that I had tickets. It was June 1985. I had the tickets for the Bruce Springsteen concert in Milan of the Born in the USA too. I sold them because I didn't want to go.
Really?
And but then I recovered thanks to another event that helped me. And I think because then I started working. I'm a journalist, and I've been a sport journalist for a consistent part of my career, and I still am.
So you go back to matches then?
Yes. And it's incredible how easily it could have been avoided, all of this. Choosing another stadium. First of all, it was...
The security measures, police.
Yeah.
The segregation of fans.
Yes. Think that there is something important to understand how the police was panicking like everyone else. They hit the first Juventus fans who tried to escape going on the track field. They hit them. Just to tell you, I'm not accused that they were panicking like everyone else. Well, they didn't have the right orders. They too should have built a line of people between the fans. Nothing would have happened.
Thank you so much for coming in to share
your
story. It's incredible, really. And I suppose it puts everything that's happened in the last 2 days with FIFA into some sort of context, actually. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Damiano. We're almost out of time. I got to go over to Tony O'Donoghue. Tony, I know you've been listening to a bit of that. I suppose it does put the events of the last couple of days into some sort of context with FIFA and Sepp Blatter, but it has been quite a strange day in Zurich. How have you found everything?
Well, to be honest, I didn't think we'd top yesterday's drama, but Sepp Blatter is involved in farce tonight, I think. Saying, you know, that there's terrible corruption in football, isn't it awful? As if it had nothing to do with him at any point, you know.
What's the reaction over there to that, Tony? What do people, are they laughing at him? Are they taking him seriously?
Well, you see, there's a difference between the reaction you'll get in the five-star hotels, you know, the palaces that the FIFA delegates tend to stay in, and the very expensive restaurants that I can't afford to go to. The rarefied atmosphere of being a FIFA representative, a FIFA delegate, and the atmosphere for the media and ordinary people. Like the newspapers here are saying, you know, time to go, Blatter. I spoke to Greg Dyke, head of the English FA today, and he said, if you're captain of the ship is going down, well, you should go down with it. That's the way it is. But nonetheless, from the soundings I'm getting here, the Asian Confederation, the African nations still seem to be supporting Blatter. So it will come down to how many votes. Now, there's a momentum gathering in favour of Prince Ali Hussein of Jordan. UEFA have said that they're going to back him, but they're not. The problem is there's 53 member states of UEFA. Not all of them will back him. Russia, for example, Putin came out today. I mean, this is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, what you were saying there about what happened 30 years ago. And football is, you know, a matter of life and death sometimes, and we should never forget that. But the fact that Putin has become out, David Cameron has come out, this is all supposed to be about sport. It's extraordinary, really. But Russia aren't going to weigh in behind UEFA. They're hopeful that 40 of their 53 member states will get behind them. And if that's the case, they feel that Prince Ali has a chance. It needs a two-thirds majority in the first vote. That would be 139. But no one sees either of them getting that at this point, although Blatter, of course, could surprise us and sweep the board. But if there's no two-thirds majority, no outright victory, it will go to a second round, and then 105 is the magic number at that point. So okay. It's all about number crunching in Zurich tonight. You can imagine there's all sorts of promises being made, all sorts of lobbying going on, and we wait and see tomorrow what the vote brings.
Well, listen, I'm sorry we got crammed for time, Tony. We're going to go into this a lot more in depth tomorrow, and we'll talk to you then. Thanks a million for your time, and
no
enjoy this
you.
Evening. Thanks, Tony O'Donoghue there, our soccer correspondent. My thanks to Connor as well. We got a bit stuck, but unfortunately the day was in it, and to Damiano.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.